Jesus had said at the cross, "It was finished," referring to his life's work and the death he came to die. And it was finished. He was glorified. He died. A perfect life was capped off by a perfect sacrifice. And he was buried. Everything that needed to happen to make peace between heaven and earth, God and humanity, Mary and her Maker, was accomplished on that Good Friday. Yet it was awfully quiet, dead quiet, that weekend for those who were closest to Jesus. The festivities were going on. Passover. Celebration of Israel's history. But they were grieving. Somber, confused, disillusioned, lost without words. When Jesus had come into Jerusalem riding on a donkey just a week earlier, the crowds had rushed together, telling each other at a sprint, "Jesus is coming! Jesus is coming!" He's coming down the Mount of Olives, as was read. "Jesus is coming." Throwing down their cloaks before him, that they might be so honored to have the Lord's anointed even trample upon their garments. There were beaming faces all around Jesus and his followers, shouting, hailing Jesus as their coming king, filled with expectation, at least filled with hope, that this was the moment they'd all been waiting for so long, Israel's complete and total deliverance. They were hoping for Isaiah's vision of the Messiah's reign of Shalom, the Prince of Peace bringing in a true and everlasting peace. And the crowd's confidence was buoyed by the word that was spreading of Jesus' awesome power, especially as was revealed in the recent raising of Lazarus. The two things are closely linked in the Gospel of John. John chapter 12, verses 12 to 13. The next day, the large crowd that had come to the feast heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. Jesus is coming. So they took branches of palm trees and went out to him, crying out, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel." What gave them such confidence about Jesus? Well, Lazarus being raised was part of that great confidence. You jump down to verse 17 to 18. The crowd that had been with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to bear witness. The reason why the crowd went to meet him was that they heard he had done this sign. And as we already heard read from Luke chapter 19, verse 37 to 38, as he was drawing near, though Lazarus isn't mentioned, Jesus' mighty works are mentioned as the reason for this crowd assembling. As he was drawing near, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that have been seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." And then they said something really interesting. "Peace in heaven." It's the one place we might imagine there already was. It's like the earth has been kind of a problem. But they said, "Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." But what would make for peace on earth? That was what the angels had first declared at Jesus' birth, right? Luke 2:14, "Glory to God in the highest and on earth." If you can fathom it, can you fathom it? Peace. goodwill toward men. What would make for that peace? Well, the answer was given that very Friday as Christ, the true King of Israel and of the whole world, was crucified. It was the answer Jesus had consistently put down as he taught, but that nobody had the wherewithal to pick up. This is just a smattering of a few of them. There are many more. Just in John's gospel, John 6:51, I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And this bread which I will give, it's subtle, but it's there, which I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. And you might wonder, well, how are you going to eat his flesh? And that's what the crowds asked. How are we going to do that? Jesus was pointing to his death, which had to be believed in for life. John 8:28. So Jesus said, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he, and that I do nothing on my own, but speak exactly what the Father has taught me. John 10:11, it's getting a little bit more clear. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And then as we pivot to the Passion Week in John chapter 12, and the whole book focuses solely on the finished work of the cross, Jesus said, John 12, 31-36, now judgment is upon this world. Now the prince of this world, think who's speaking, the prince of peace, is telling us what will happen to the prince of chaos. The prince of this world will be cast out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw everyone to myself. He said this to indicate what kind of death he was going to die. The crowd replied with at least some level of understanding now. We have heard from the law that the Christ will remain forever. So how can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man? Then Jesus told them, for a little while longer, the light will be among you. Walk while you have the light, so that darkness will not overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light so that you may become sons of light. But Friday led into Saturday, and Saturday bled into Sunday morning, and still a deep darkness had overtaken Jesus' followers. The Sunday after a gruesome Friday and a torturously long Saturday, what some have dubbed the Silent Saturday. As John points out uniquely, the other Gospels talk about the women coming to the tomb early in the day or at first dawn. But John, with characteristic, I think, theological weight in his words, he says, Mary Magdalene approached the Lord's tomb early that Sunday while it was still dark. And we might think it was dark in more ways than one. When John himself uses that term for darkness, which is not the most typical word for common darkness used in the New Testament, there's a word that's used much more prevalently, much more often. In fact, most of the uses of the word are in John's gospel. And the vast majority of them, whether he's using them in his gospel or in his epistle, they're almost always referring to theological ideas. Darkness as evil, and not just as the lights being off. John 1:5, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. This is more than just the lights coming on. John 8:12, again Jesus spoke to them saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. The only other time John uses this word outside of this garden scene to describe what we might think is just a mere physical darkness, in that setting, Isn't it interesting? It's when the disciples are once again separated from Jesus, the light of the world. And so it still carries its theological freight with it. John 6:17, referring to the disciples, they got into the boat and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. This was right before he walked on the water out to them. Before he would utter what to the waves? Peace. The Prince of Peace, calming the storms. And now here, Jesus is coming. Indeed, he has risen, but he has not yet come to them. And so darkness still envelops Jesus' following. And we can be relatively sure, especially based on their responses to Jesus, even when he is risen, we can be sure that those who approached and that those who stayed behind, hidden indoors alike, they did not feel anything like freedom on their liberation day or the day after. By the third day, Jesus' disciples were in emotional free fall. But thank God for the women. Is that a surprise? We have a stereotype that women are the emotional ones. Don't talk to our wives. You can't always trust your feelings. While women tend to be pegged as the emotional ones, it is the men here among the inner circle of Jesus whose emotions kept them glued to the floor behind locked doors. Credit to the women. Now, I'm not sure about Mary Magdalene's feelings that morning. I don't know how she felt. None of us do. We might imagine some of what she felt and base that somewhat on how she responded to the empty tomb and then later to her risen Lord, even to the angels. I'm not sure if she slept well that night. I'm not sure if she had bad dreams. I'm not sure if she managed to eat something before she left the house. Or if in her grief, which we do see her grieving and weeping even after the fact here, maybe she was not able to eat yet. We have some suggestion because of her shock later and her weeping. But we don't really know her emotional and her mental state. What we do know is that she knew the Sabbath had just passed. The Sabbath had just passed, and this was now the earliest feasible time for her to come to Jesus. Even though the Sabbath technically would have ended the night prior at dusk. I always confuse dawn and dusk. It wouldn't have been appropriate. It wouldn't have been safe for her to go out at night, certainly not alone. And so now, at the earliest feasible time, here she was on her feet, following after Jesus. And we at least understand some of her intention with that. We might like to speculate about if she had a little bit of hope, if she had a little bit of remembrance about what Jesus had said about the third day. But as far as we can tell, across the four different gospel accounts of this, the women were approaching with spices to anoint Jesus yet again. And even that, you might think for a moment that maybe they were trying to preserve Jesus' body, to give him time to fulfill what he had said. But here's where it's helpful to understand that Jewish burial custom, they did not anoint the body to preserve it, but just to fend off stench. In fact, they desired the opposite effect. While they wanted, they would put oils and spices on the body to prevent the smell, it would not stop in any way the decay of the body. And that was ideal because the goal would be to have all of the flesh rot off the bones within the first year so that you could move the bones. And then you could make way for another body to come. But remember, this was a new tomb, and this was the first body on it. But the women were not coming to preserve Jesus. That was not what the Jews did. They were not Egyptians like that. That's why it was a surprise in the Bible when Joseph was embalmed and preserved in a unique way. But even then, he said, at the end of all this, take my bones with you. Don't leave them here. So we don't know all about Mary's emotional state, but we know and we can credit her and the other women who were with her with moving their feet. I know it might feel like a reach for an application, but I think it's a worthwhile one. There are many times in the Christian life when we just do not feel like it. I don't want to pray. I don't want to open my Bible. Certainly don't want to talk to another person or reach out to someone or encourage someone. I need encouragement. Ironically, one of the best ways to get encouragement is to give it. But however small here, there is a vivid lesson of not being led by your feelings. The disciples, the men of the disciples were locked away, but here the women came forward. And wow, were they rewarded, and was Mary Magdalene rewarded for doing exactly that. For she would not only be privileged to see Jesus first, but also she would be honored, she would be rewarded for what would be said of her. Each of the four gospel accounts cover this territory. And interestingly enough, each of them places emphasis in a different place and include different names among the women who approached. Some listing the women and then saying, and others were with them too. Here, we see Mary is particularly made to stand out. Although we know even from John's writing that she was not alone. Because in verse 2, we are told what? From her own testimony, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. So she wasn't alone, and yet John chooses to emphasize her. Indeed, of all the names that are included in the different lists of women who come to the tomb that first Lord's Day, whose name is it that makes the cut on every list? It's Mary Magdalene. Her? We don't know a lot of her backstory, but what we know of her makes us go, her? She's the one chosen? She makes the cut in every scene? She is emphasized, her faithfulness, her following Jesus? There are other women there you could have chose, women with a cleaner resume, let's say it that way. This is the woman who had no less than 7 demons cast out of her. I tend to think having 1 demon cast out of you is pretty bad on your record spiritually. You know, we don't usually embark on a conversation, hey, how many demons have you had cast out of yourself? And she, 7. And yet it's her. She before anyone, before Peter, the rock, before John, before any other man, she, a woman, who legally, according to Jewish understanding, her testimony would not even be legally valid. I'm not trying to offend you with that. That's just the state of affairs at the time. A woman's testimony did not stand. You need to find other witnesses. Find some men who saw what happened. And yet the Gospels are not embarrassed. And our Lord is not embarrassed to put the women first here. as the first and best examples, the first and best witnesses. She gets the honor forever to make ready, to announce, to make way for the king. Now, to be sure, those were not her words. What are her words? The word taken comes to mind. The word shows up again and again and again within what you heard read today, and then in the next passage, and that we could certainly take a look at the story together. Verse 1, first it's the stone that was seen taken from the tomb. And then verse 2, her own words, they have taken the Lord. And that's a good confession there because she's identifying Jesus as the Lord still. And then in verse 13, it's beyond the scope of directly what we're looking at today, but it's certainly in context. Verse 13, when she's weeping and speaking to angels, she is still so distraught that she says, "They have taken away my Lord," before angels. And even before Jesus himself, before she has the wherewithal to recognize who she's speaking to and mistakes him for a gardener. Verse 15, Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him and I will take him. I will take him." And so Mary's perspective to this point is that Jesus is taken rather than that he is risen. What does she mean? She says, "Jesus is taken." Well, the most natural understanding of this is that she presumes that whether the Jewish leadership, for some strange reason, or someone else, they have robbed his grave. They have robbed his grave. This is not a totally uncommon thing. In fact, at some point in Rome's history, I believe within this century, one of the Roman leaders made it a law, made it a capital offense to rob a grave because it had become common enough. And it was a despicable act across any culture. Remains so today, to rob a grave. And yet, that appears at the surface level to Mary, what has happened. How else could you make sense of this? Now, she hasn't gone all the way into the tomb. She hasn't seen everything. But what she has seen leads her to believe what she says to the disciples, and that is, "They have taken the Lord." Interestingly, her take on things is the exact, it's a little ironic here, but it's the exact same line that the Jewish leaders would employ, but just in the other direction. The Jewish leaders would say, "They have taken the Lord." Even though there was a guard put on him, even though the disciples are locked away, frozen in their feelings. But when the Jewish leadership faced increasing inquiries from the populace, their claim was the same. They have taken him, and his body never surfaced, except when it was seen resurrected. One commentator said this, that I think well argues against the thought that the disciples would have had the wherewithal to rob Jesus' grave. Said this, "If the disciples did not protect Jesus while he was alive, surely they would not have risked their lives to rob his tomb after his death." And then after talking about their own psychology in that moment and how shaken they were, another commentator said this, "Above all, since neither they nor anyone else expected a resurrection. And what he means here, he's not talking about an eventual resurrection. For many of the Jews did believe in that. That seemed to be the common view. Some did not believe in a resurrection like that, but the vast majority, certainly of the populace and among the Pharisees, they did believe, in keeping with Daniel chapter 12 and other passages, there would be a resurrection. But that would be way out there. That would be way out there, and that would be with everybody. One big general resurrection. That's the one we're waiting for. So it's not like unconscionable that they would think that. The part that they weren't expecting was one person to be risen in this manner, a one-off resurrection. Above all, since they nor anyone else expected a resurrection, there would have been no purpose in faking one. You see that? No one was looking for this, including the disciples. So even when Jesus was raised, it's not like they immediately went, oh, it makes perfect sense. Some believed and some doubted. Some even needed to touch him. It was easier to think he was an aberration than that he was risen. Then we come to Peter and presumably John, the disciple affectionately known as the one whom Jesus loved. Mary's current persuasion notwithstanding, her confused announcement to them was a sufficient catalyst to get both Peter and John off the couch of despair in a hurry. We see them running together to the tomb, running. It's not a common thing you see a Jewish person doing. It's part of what makes the story of the prodigal son, what some have even dubbed the prodigal father, because he departs from so much Jewish custom. Part of what makes that story so baffling and beautiful is that a grown man is seen girding up his loins and running. It's something unbecoming. And yet here, Peter and John, formerly frozen, are running free. They didn't know yet that Jesus was coming. They didn't know that he was coming to them, despite Mary Magdalene's announcement. But finally, they were once again coming to Jesus. And again, this is a great reminder. Where are you right now in your headspace? Where are you right now in your emotional life? Where are you right now in your mental well-being? Okay, these are common things that are now talked about today that 20, 30 years ago, 50 years were taboo, but now everyone's talking about their mental health. Okay, well and good to a point. But we are not to be led by our current state of mental health. Especially if our mental health is making us feel defeated or trapped or lost. Don't listen to that. Why would you listen to that? Run to Jesus. That might seem like a weird application, but it's what these guys did and it's what I'd urge you to do. You run to Jesus. I don't want to open the word. I don't feel like it. Open the word anyway. I don't want to pray. Get on your knees. It is amazing what, I mean, I'm speaking for myself as someone who knows it's hard to be before the Lord in prayer for 15 minutes straight, okay? 3 minutes on your actual knees before the Lord, that will do wonders for you, including and especially when you do not feel like it. Do not listen, do not live by your feelings. Your feelings can tell you the truth. My feelings for my wife can tell me the truth. But sometimes my feelings for my children do not tell me the truth. That they are gifts from God and so wonderful. And so Peter and John There's this fun little bit about them racing, and John's apparently faster than Peter quite a bit. Enough to get in there and take a look in, see that things are empty as the report given to them indicated. But he didn't yet go in. We might wonder what all of this is about. And I don't quite know myself. I just know that something like it happened this morning. My parents got here before I did, but I got into the church before they did. Whatever the case, Peter gets in, and something he sees, and then something that John sees, because John follows in afterwards, it starts to change the math, and it starts to turn their feelings. For Peter, as indicated in Luke, when he refers to the same scene, he says he saw the grave clothes, and something in that moment, something about that whole scene, it messed with him in the best way. Luke says he went away wondering. And yet John here looks at the same scene and he walks away, it says, believing. Now we could, at a very superficial level, we could say, maybe John's just saying he believed the report now from Mary that she had said Jesus was taken. His grave was robbed. I think John, when he uses that type of language, belief, faithfully has used that throughout the gospel, he means more. I think he means that he agrees with Mary's statement that Jesus' grave has been robbed, but he believes that it is Jesus who has robbed his own grave and no one else. What did they see that made Peter wonder and that made John believe? What did they see? They saw a scene, first of all, that makes no sense for a late night theft. They don't see things disheveled. They don't see the body or the bones, which is the one thing you would think you wouldn't want to steal. Who wants to steal a body? There would be some, but it's a very narrow group of people. The only people who would want to steal the body or the bones or something like that were people involved in some type of witchcraft or magic, because they believed that there might be power in it. Specifically, if a body had died in a violent manner. Okay? So there was that possibility. But that's a stretch. What's a bigger stretch is why you would take the body and leave the clothes. In terms of just from a financial perspective, the linens are worth more than the body. And they would be. That's why it's startling when we see the cloaks thrown down before Jesus, because they weren't ordering stuff on Temu. They might have only had a garment. You know, when you read in somewhere in the Old Testament that someone had two tunics, like, whoa, two tunics. It was precious. So you take the body and leave the linens? More than that, it's not like the linens are left in disarray. This isn't some chaotic scene where we just got to get to the body or maybe see if there's jewelry on the body. None of that is the case. What we see is a well-ordered scene, which is, I'm just going to say it, I don't want to typecast all thieves, okay? I don't want to do that. I don't want to be a broad brush, say all thieves are the same, but most thieves, I'm going to say it, I'm going to just throw out a generality, okay? I'm going to stereotype them. Most thieves do not care what your tomb looks like when they rob your grave. Maybe these guys were different. They were real OCD type thieves, and they just, you got all the stuff? Good. You got the, oh, get the face cloth. You can't leave the face cloth like that. Come on. Come on. You got to fold it up. Be respectful. You get the bones? Like, this is not the scene. And these guys are seeing this. All this to say. And it was this empty tomb was speaking loudly to these disciples. And what they were hearing, whether or not they could believe it, John appeared to believe it. What they were hearing from the evidence before them was that Jesus was not taken, but he was risen. That he is risen. It's interesting that John's belief is tied in some way to his lack of understanding. Let me point to this for a second, and then we'll wrap up here. Just follow with me, because the connection seems a bit odd. Verse 8, the other disciple, so John always refers to himself, we presume it's him, in this humble way, he doesn't name himself. Then the other disciple who had reached the tomb first, the fast guy, also went in, and he saw and believed. He saw and believed. This wasn't like the scene of Lazarus. Lazarus, when he was raised, needed to be unbound by others. But here we see the grave clothes. Maybe even as if Jesus' body came through them. We don't know that. We can't say that. Some have speculated that. Maybe part of what was left had the shape of him, but his body was gone because the oil and spices might have held it to a degree. I don't know that. What we know is that these grave clothes spoke loudly to them. And John believed. But then his belief is connected with his not quite understanding. Now, most of the times I've read it this way. And he saw and believed because formerly he didn't understand. But that's not actually what the text says. The text says, for as yet, or like even now, it's an ongoing thing. They did not understand. And it doesn't use a past tense. They hadn't understood. It uses a present, an ongoing. They did not understand. And you might go, how do these things work together? He believed, but he didn't understand. Well, the answer is they work together all the time. All the time. In belief, there is very often a gap because what we count on, what we hope in with a degree of certainty, and what we, on the other hand, yet understand with only very little clarity. Let me say it this way. We can be certain something works without understanding how it works. Does anyone here use the internet? None of you? Come on. Okay, you're sleeping. Use the internet. Please answer with your arm. Someone funny is doing that. Okay, so everyone uses the internet. And who of you knows exactly how it works? Does it work? You believe that? And you don't know. None of you knows how it works, and you all believe that. I believe Australia exists, though I've never been there. I've heard the accents, and I see Jill over there, so that's good enough for me. When we know something works without understanding how it works, we might explain that in a number of ways, or we might have no explanation. We might think it magic, we might think it superstition, we might think it odd. We might just accept that for the moment, it's beyond our comprehension. And yet we believe for ourselves something that we can't quite explain to another person. And yet we can still, like a good evangelist, tell someone that this thing works. I don't know how it works. Look, there's this internet thing. I don't know how it works, but it works. You put words onto the computer, and then it brings up other words and ideas from other places. Really? It works. You all got used to it. But that was weird at first. So you can be an evangelist without being a theologian. By the way, that's what you're invited to do. I remind you again, you have those little cards in front of you. I have some in my Bible. I already put one against federal law into a neighbor's mailbox. Go ahead and give that to someone. I'm not a good evangelist. Well, can you do this action? Okay? This is not complicated stuff. If you can do that, you can be well on your way to being an evangelist. And I encourage you to do that. Easter is an easy time relative to other times for people to come to Jesus. So I urge you, invite them to sunrise, invite them to Easter service, maybe even Good Friday. I think what is said about John here is that he still, even now, until he would be before Jesus and Jesus would start explaining the whole picture, he didn't understand the scriptures. He didn't understand Jesus' own words that were repeated over and over. And yet he looked and he believed. And so often that's the case with us. I don't have to know how food works. I've told you before that I'm very stupid in terms of understanding the human body. I'm getting better at understanding the human spirit. Maybe approaching some understanding of the human mind, but the human body, total mystery to me. It's like magic. My wife understands it. But I know that if I'm hungry and I eat a sandwich, that works. I don't know how it works, but I know it works. I don't need to understand the complexities of what's happening to be satiated. So often, for people, it's the same with Jesus, especially as we are first coming to Jesus. We have no idea how this works. But someone else has told us it works. They have shown us with their lives that it works. And now, all of a sudden, it's beginning to work for me. The peace that passes all understanding, it's beginning to be my peace. He's beginning to be my Lord. On Good Friday, Israel's long-awaited hopes, they were realized and beyond any measuring out, and yet the events of that day did not measure up to anyone's expectations except Jesus' own. But now, early on Sunday, the deliverance that was secured on the cross was on its way to being delivered to the hearts and minds of those who followed Jesus. They were free, and they didn't even know it yet. They didn't feel free, but they were. Some days, you wake up as a Christian, and you cannot explain it. You cannot explain those feelings. You can't articulate it. You can't tie it to last night's tacos, or last night's dream, or last week's conversation. Sometimes you just wake up, and you feel lost, or you feel alone, or you feel enslaved, or you feel stuck. And you need to listen to what Jesus has said to you if you are in him. You are free. His deliverance was total. And you can walk in that freedom. Even when you don't feel like it. And when you do that, especially when you do that, when you do for Christ what you don't feel like doing, that is a unique praise before him. When we do the thing that's hard that we don't feel like, and we trust God. When we don't understand, we say, I trust you anyway. I believe you anyway. I follow you anyway. I'm opening up the word again. I'm praying again. That's a unique, I think that brings a unique smile to the Father's face. Jesus was coming again to them. And we should remember that we do not see him now. Jesus is coming again for us. He's coming again. He has come to our hearts, but we will see him. They hadn't seen him yet, but they would. In his mercy, he didn't need to do that. He didn't need to show himself. He didn't need to prove himself. He didn't need to explain himself. But he did all that, that we might believe and believe all the more. He didn't need to give you the gifts he gave you, give you the friendships he gave you, give you the church he gave you, but he did. He didn't need to give you any of that. But what he gave you, glorify him for. Thank you, Lord. So while many had hoped for Israel's deliverance by a show of great force through Jesus' mighty hands, it was the demonstration of divine love and justice through his nail-pierced hands that won Israel her true freedom. True Israel, true freedom, and ours. But nobody would grasp that completely until Jesus had robbed the grave. Indeed, the grave was robbed, but it was Jesus robbing it, no one else. And if Jesus has robbed the grave, remember, as you go about this week, he is taking those with him who follow after him, those who believe in him. He said, I will take you to myself. I will not leave you alone. I will take you to myself. You can't come now, but you will come afterwards. Jesus is coming for you. Every one of you, you have believed in him. He is coming for you. You want to be ready for that. You don't want to have to see that day with great shame. None of us will be perfect at his coming. But will he find faith among us when he comes? One thing was taken away when Jesus robbed the grave, and that is our sin. 1 John 3:5. Let me remind you of it and close with these great words. 1 John 3:5. You know that he appeared in order to take away sins, and in him there is no sin. If Christ has set you free, you are free indeed. Walk in freedom and invite others into it. Invite them to church. Invite them to sunrise service. Invite them into your life, into your home, and keep following Jesus. Amen.